My haircuts never quite turned out. Yeah. So I was always going into school and having a not so great haircut, or not knowing how do you manipulate.
Yeah, we all had big hair. All three of us had big hair. Yeah. Have you guys ever gotten a haircut like when you were a kid that your parents had to fix afterwards?
Oh my god, I had one, and I had to go back in there and tell them to just cut it way shorter.
So you
like,
actually went back in.
Yeah, man.
I had one where the guy had a bad '80s haircut, and when I left, I had a haircut.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I had a bad '80s haircut, like kind of like bunchy around the ears and like a mullet swoop in the back. It was fucking terrible.
When you take your past,
I remember
it's so
saying
hard to
like
find somebody who can cut big hair well. Like,
well, I remember thinking like I'm gonna say this looks bad, and my mom's gonna say no, it looks fine. And I said to my mom like, my haircut looks bad, and she just kind of giggled and said, we'll fix it when we get home.
Hi, you're listening to People Are Strange, a podcast starring me, Andy, and me, JK. Please be advised, this show contains strong language and explicit descriptions of adult situations. People Are Strange is not intended to promote the use of drugs or a life in the arts. If you do decide to experiment, please do so from an informed and responsible place. Now, sit back, relax, and enjoy, because after all, people are strange.
Good to go. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So we're doing something new and exciting today. We have a guest in our studio, highly professional chrome studio.
Up in the tree room.
Up in the tree room. Yes,
with Mustafa.
Mustafa or Mustafa. Mo.
Mo.
Either will work.
Cool.
Hi guys, thanks for having me.
So Mustafa, you're a somewhat of a Renaissance man. That's how I kind of think of you. I mean, recently, in the past, I don't know, year and a half, you've had very successful art opening, right? You a studio or art show, I guess. You sold almost all your paintings, if I'm correct. What medium do you work in mostly? What's your favorite medium?
Or do you have one? It was mostly acrylic, but I was experimenting with some new things. Experiment for me.
Bodily fluids, dirt.
Some bile. No, it was just ink, acrylic, and soap, dish soap.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I used dish soap to break up the surface tension, and I pooled the acrylic. I would mix it with a lot of water, and I'd create a pool of color, and then I'd take a toothpick with dish soap on it, and I'd run it through and constellations.
That's awesome.
And things.
Wow. Yeah. You're not just a painter, though. You're also working in other mediums completely.
Yeah. In fact, I studied acting.
Now, I saw you do a show that you both wrote and directed, a one-man show, like a few months ago in the winter.
I was able to find a seat, sneak through the huge crowd of people that had amassed.
You drew
and find
a massive
a little spot
crowd
at the front.
Yeah, and we live in an area where people don't necessarily come out in big numbers to see theater. So I was blown away when I walked in, and not only that, but you have.
I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Maybe they do get down with theater in the old Naptown, but
it's kind of. I mean, it was really great to. I consider myself a bit of a socialite, I suppose.
So were you surprised to see that many people there?
I did a lot of online blasting about it, and I'd had a month prior to the show to kind of spread the word, and I was also putting together the set at the time, and finding the space. And so
you're a Renaissance man. See.
It was the whole production. I wrote it, did the set, acted in it. And yeah, it was great to have that many people. I did three shows that one night. It's about a 30-minute long play, and
you had some intense makeup going on in that too. Did you do that as well?
Yes. Yeah.
So you were a severed body, correct?
Yes.
You were a severed torso.
The upper half of a Middle Eastern suicide bomber, although not particular to where in the Middle East the character was from.
Mm-hmm.
Just a suicide bomber leaning up against a tree, telling the story of how he was cheating on his wife, and how he didn't feel ready to be a father, and how he ended up at this pear field, severed in half, no one around.
Nice.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, you have always had a style of writing since I've known you that is very like metaphoric and symbolic. Did you find that people picked up on exactly what you were talking about a lot of the time? Or
certainly.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And in a lot of ways, they came up with more extrapolating on the script that I hadn't thought about, but that I say I thought about it.
Yeah,
I've heard it,
yeah. You know? Yeah. That sounds good. Yeah,
I mean that, and that's the good thing. And I've heard you say David Lynch before, and I obviously pull a lot from absurdist theater and surrealist theater, and Beckett's a favorite of mine, and it's definitely in that style of sparse theatrical production wise, but very heavy on the philosophical nudgings.
Let's hear about when you were kind of first maybe inspired with the arts. When
was the first thing you did theater?
I started with photography in high school, and I was really into photography in a dark room a lot of time, and it was my favorite class, and I had an SLR, old 70s Canon, and that was the first time I'd gotten a chance to find a different medium aside from drawing, which I assumed everybody did growing up.
So you drew a lot before you
did
pictures.
I sketched a lot and I doodled a lot. But
just pen or draw, ink? Like, or?
Monsters or like real things?
Oh, well, a lot of comic book things.
Superheroes.
So obviously, I grew up reading them, so I grew up drawing them.
Who's your favorite superhero?
My favorite? Wow. Oh, man.
Have you never thought about this?
Probably Nightcrawler. I think X-Men in general kind of has always been my favorite because of the metaphor of race and xenophobia. And I've always kind of felt that's resonated with me a lot.
Yeah, for those who, maybe listening and maybe meeting you for the first time, you do come from a Egyptian background here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Does that influence you as an artist? I mean, we talked about the one project that you've already done, the pear tree.
Well, I gotta say, I definitely don't... I definitely, socially, am what most would consider Caucasian, and the United States government still technically considers me Caucasian, as I am from the Middle East. And I think it's been an interesting life to live, to grow up with that dichotomy of race and what it means to fit in somewhere socially based on the color of my skin has always been a very obvious thing for me growing up. So, before September 11th, I was just another probably Hispanic kid. After was when people started seeing me and maybe double taking and it was the last time I remember being in Egypt. And I remember my late grandmother, she was saying something about the housemaid who was Somalian. And I remember thinking, gosh, this shit happens all over the world. Like, there's no escaping it. Everybody's...
So your grandmother is racist against Somalians?
Well, as a lot of... as some people, of a certain age might be in Egypt, Somalians I assume have been at war for a long time, so a lot of refugees come into the Middle East.
Yeah, anytime there's immigration, you get that attitude of, they're taking our jobs, man! Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter, it could be in, Denmark, they're taking our jobs, That wasn't a Denmarkian accent, but you get the idea.
It might have been.
Dutch? Is that Danish?
So, Mo, what do you think the most interesting space that you've ever kind of performed in? Most kind of unconventional...
Strangest space.
Oh, yeah. This is cool.
Yeah.
I gotta say, when I first wrote that play, I wanted to perform it in an abandoned warehouse.
Which play is this?
The Pear Tree.
Oh, okay.
This suicide bomber play. And initially, I had the image in my head of a sort of Wallace Shawn kind of, at the beginning of his career, performing in some abandoned hotel in one of the rooms for 10 people. You know what I mean? I kind of had that. And a big part of it was also that I wasn't severed, that I was actually going to be standing there with a big jacket so that the audience would have to deal with the fear the whole time of whether or not this was an actual bombing. But of course, time went on and everything's been happening. Yeah. So I said, okay, maybe I have to be a little bit more theatrical about this. So I severed my legs off for the play. And, I have makeup.
I grabbed a saw
for your art.
Bit
for
into
your
a art. Hose and I chopped my legs off.
I performed it in a shop. It was just a shop that didn't have a store in it.
The Pear Tree.
Yeah, it was storefront empty property. Shop.
Yeah.
And I leveraged my relationship with the person who owned the space and got it for that one night.
Your superhuman networking skills.
Yeah, it was really
friend man
hustling this day. Yeah, so that was a very interesting place to perform. I mean, I performed The Lion King in my room with my stuffed animals. I guess that would be pretty interesting.
Sure. Did you have an audience for that? Aside from
my stuffed animals? Oh, right. No.
How were they? Were they kind or?
They were. Yeah.
How were they? Ambivalent.
Very critical.
They didn't care for it. Well, when I graduated college with my, degree in acting.
Like the pause before degree.
my certification.
My degree in acting.
Well, that's a big choice, and you guys probably know that choice too, that feeling of where do I go with this? Do I go to New York and audition for theater off Broadway, or do I go to Los Angeles and try to find auditions for film and television and commercial work? Do I go to France and find some niche independent film company that
should be a lot of fun, probably
great fun, right?
Yeah.
But I kind of thought to myself that those were all perhaps recipes for my eventual distaste for the culture and for the process. So I graduated and I thought, I'm really stern in this. I'm going to make my own work. I'm going to have people audition for me. I'm going to be really super selective about the work that I agree to do with other people. And that kind of propelled me into the direction of producing my own work on a small scale, while also being really selective about the work that I do with other people. So kind of missing your question here.
You know, was there a moment where it kind of clicked for you to go, from, all right, I'm enjoying this, I'm doing this, to making a life in it as you are?
Yeah. Well, I gotta say, I think maybe before I even realized how much I loved it, before that, when I decided to do theater in college, I think that was the moment that it clicked. I knew at that point there was no money in it. So the only intention I could have was to just be a part of it in a community way, in just a, I want to just do this, versus being it and going full force into creating things and displaying it for people and having an audience and doing talkbacks and things like that. So,
is there a reason you picked theater?
It was between theater and computer science. I knew I loved theater, but I wasn't being given the opportunities that I wanted to do it. And I think that was probably...
So you just knew that you loved it without even really...
Yeah, well, and I think it was also tied to my want to be involved with video games, which I know is a strange distinction to make, but...
I'm sure there's a link, because I'm addicted to both of those.
There's very much a link, and good choice of words. The first time I ever really experienced catharsis, I think, was when I was playing The Legend of Zelda. And I think the music of it and the medium of it really resonated with me, and it was interactive on top of that, so...
For what console?
Nintendo 64.
Yeah, okay. The best one. Ocarina of Time.
Ocarina of Time, yeah.
No, it's interesting because, video games... A lot of people don't realize that video games are absolutely a valid art form in the same way that movies are and plays are and everything, because they are that multimedia experience, where the really good ones, have a real composer who has written music, In a sense, there's the graphics are kind
actors,
of like the
voice
light.
Actors,
yeah, there's actors,
designers,
right?
Sure.
And they make you feel for those characters. And, in order for that to work and to make you feel the emotions that Mo is talking about right now, it all has to come together in the same way that a theater performance does.
Very much an ensemble.
Whatever that it is that makes it special and makes it resonate with people. Because that's what makes something special, right? When it resonates with people.
Right.
When people see it and they think, oh yeah, this triggers that thing inside me.
Empathy.
That empathy.
Well, I think you could probably resonate differently for different people as well. Sometimes if you're able to target, you know, a broad audience, you know, and
sometimes it's alienation. Sometimes it's the opposite of empathy, especially with absurdist theater. You're trying. We saw a lot of times, you know, Waiting for Godot. That's all about making you feel alone in the universe. Right. You know?
Well, are you alone if you have your friend there next to you?
Right. That's a thing. You know, maybe that's what it's all about.
Question.
Yeah. That's, you know, you get a very different feeling depending on who directs it. It's an interesting thing.
And where you're seeing it? Did you hear about that production, how the first, when it was first being done, it was getting terrible reviews, Waiting for Godot. No one was responding to it. Everyone was kind of like, we don't really get it. Mm-hmm. And then they went and performed it in a prison, and the crowd went insane. Like, all the prisoners were just like,
wow.
It spoke to them so that's much in a way deep. That no one on the outside could understand.
Yeah.
They were, you know, they could understand that feeling of waiting and not knowing when the other kind of shoe is going to drop or when some outside force is going to come crossing by.
Right.
But if you're living outside of that cage, outside of that prison, you don't get it. And so people looked at it in a whole new light after that. So what's the most fun you've ever had on a piece of art, on a production, whether it's theater, whether it's painting, whether it's working for, you know, getting your gallery together? What's the most fun that you've ever had?
I gotta say, I'm having the most fun I ever had recently working on a comic book.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's been, I wrote a screenplay and now I've decided it's a comic book. So I've been working with a photographer to take pictures of all the scenes as I've written them and then compile the pages and then painting over top of it. And I gotta say, just the procedural part of it. And now that I've sliced off the beginning and the end of it and I have this open thing that I can keep writing episodically.
So you're writing it and they're taking pictures of it and then you're editing it to
We'll be creating the frames of the comic with the photographs.
Awesome.
And then doing
I remember you worked on a project somewhat similar to this years ago.
I did.
Yeah.
And that was very eye opening.
Always grinding away
in this in that medium. And it's, you know, what's always been important to me in to ensure that we have young people back in live theater audiences is blending the mediums and their genres.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've always thought to myself, well, I'm going to do a play, I want to do a sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to do a movie, I want it to just be a gritty character study.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing a comic book, I want it to be about, you know, spirits but also interpersonal dramas, you know. So that's always been a big thing for me, is the video game world, the comic book world, the theater world, and the film world.
Nice.
And kind of taking from each of them and borrowing from each of them to create different things.
Yeah.
And obviously I'm not coming up with any brand new ideas, but perhaps if I do it in a certain way, it'll...
The fact that you're doing it, you know, is going to make it unique in and of itself. So
it will be brand new.
I hope so.
So now, okay, so that's the most fun you're having. Now, what's the strangest experience that you've ever been a part of?
Maybe like...
I mimed at a beer festival once.
Yeah. Okay.
What was that like?
That was awful.
Did you ever break the mime? Like,
yes.
Were people really...
In fact, I got so tired. It was so hot out. It was shitty makeup that I had, so it sweat off my face easily five times.
Were people fucking with you a lot because they were drunk?
People were drunk, but they were kind of, you know, ambivalent to the guy in white makeup that's dripping off his...
Drunk people ambivalent to a mime?
Well, they would smile sometimes. But the thing of it was that I got to a point where I was getting so exhausted, heat exhausted, that I couldn't even...
You were becoming quite surly.
I was becoming surly, and eventually...
Nothing worse than a surly mime.
Right. Surly. And usually my character of mime is, you know, you're used to seeing mime as the down and out kind of the poor character.
You're an in your face mime.
I'm the mime that I play is a martini wielding entitled prick from Annapolis, Maryland. You know what I mean? Like the boater that you see with the sweat
fresh off the yacht.
Yes, my Sperry's are on. My boat shoes are on. My that was the character that I was playing. Eventually, I was just, my makeup is sweating off me. I'm holding a little sign, a literal sign that says mime on it. Eventually, I just started walking up to people saying, you know,
hey, do you have any spare change? I'm an artist. I really need a buck. Catch the bus.
Yeah. Or, I'm in a box. I'd just say it. I would just tell it to them, and then when they looked at me, I would kind of say, did you like that one?
I'm playing tug of war here. It's very windy. Right. It's very windy. It's windy. Do you see this?
Whoa. Oh, my umbrella is flying away from me. That's my biggest piece of advice to anybody out there who's interested in being a part of the performance art career lifestyle. And that is, you have to have fun when you go to an audition. That is like, I think that's baseline. You should have fun at an audition.
Well, that's the most unpleasant thing, I think.
Right, but...
maybe besides tech week, perhaps, but... the auditions are really the worst part of it, you know. It's like endless job interviews.
Perspective on it.
Yeah, right. But regardless, though, the worst part.
It's tough.
They're the toughest part.
Everyone knows they're awkward going into it, though. Mm-hmm. So if you, instead of looking at it like putting so much
awkward
pressure on it, you know, if you're able to just look at it as one audition amongst many, an opportunity to practice your whatever, hone your craft, and get better, then that makes it a little less important than, like, I need this, I have to have this job, I need it to live, I need it for whatever, I need it for... you know, that builds it up to be something that's so much harder to grab than if it's, you know, well, if I get this, great. If I don't, I'll find another audition. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of takes the pressure off of it.
Yeah.
And I found it easier auditioning for people I don't know than for people I do know. Because
really?
When you do know people, it's like, you care so much more about what they think of you, too. And you know that you're going to...
know what they expect of you.
Yeah, and you're going to have to continue to interact with them after this audition. If you're going to just audition for whoever, you know, you could have a bad audition, and you can just chalk that up to whatever. You know, maybe you'll never even see the person again. But if you know the person, it's like, oh, no, you really care about putting a nice audition. I mean, you know, you fuck it up, whatever. They still know you can do work based on having
usually
you
still get the part if they know
well,
you.
Depending, but you know, it's still like you care a lot more.
Yeah, you've turned your tank top into a sort of bikini kind of
the
role.
Tree room studio has gotten a bit warm through
it is very moist in here at the moment,
but we are soldiering on like good artists.
Yeah,
well, we work in unique spaces.
Yeah. I'd say this is the strangest.
Have you ever done a show really sick?
You missed it, Mo just said that this is his strangest. Yeah.
That's what we aspire to.
This is
to.
My strangest.
Yeah. Strangity.
I had just gotten my appendix out when I did Sexual Perversity in Chicago.
Oh.
So that was kind of... oof. It was a week after the operation, so... okay.
What was your question? I missed it.
With the sickest, if you've ever been sick to doing a show.
Yeah.
Everybody's done a show real sick.
Oh,
because we were talking
God.
About committing
oh,
to...
oh, man.
You know, I was 12 years old, and I did a show with 102 degree fever once. It was a goddamn nightmare. It was the greatest Christmas pageant ever, which is one of the worst... it's one of those shows that they just force kids to do in high school and community theater. I'm not even going to dignify it by describing it.
Yeah. I remember for one of the theater festivals that we were doing, it was the county theater festival that our high school was hosting. But we were still supposed to do go up for the improv show.
Uh-huh.
And I was so sick this day. I was just like fevering and congested and just like so worthless. Like I slept and like lay down in the back of the theater like in the darkness throughout the whole festival. And then for like the improv part, me and this other girl from our school, from our improv team, went down there and we went to perform in front of the whole auditorium of schools from all over the county. And I was so sick. And we went up there and I did like one little like joke in, I think it might have been like World's Worst or something, like some line game. I jump up there and I think I had like snot hanging out of my face and just like, oh, it was real trouble. And of course, that day, someone takes a picture of me doing that like little like line game thing, and that makes it into the newspaper for like the Comedy Theater Festival.
Just like my fake quote.
Yes. Oh my god. You might not have heard this, Mo, but
I wrote an article for the high school newspaper.
Oh my god.
That had a false quote from JK in there.
And he told me afterwards, he was like, yeah, I was writing this article and I needed a minimum number
of quotes.
So I just like made something up for you. I'm like, dude, why didn't you just ask me? I would have like given you something. No, I just made something up. And I never knew what he said.
The quote was, we were like so funny, we absolutely killed at this festival talking about us doing comedy. And he was like, one girl laughed so hard she fell out of her chair.
No, she literally
fell
out of her chair.
Yeah. And so if you Google his name, one of the first things that pops up.
Yeah, now all of a sudden, they like the newspaper, like the local newspaper, like republished it years later in an article about like the county festival or something.
Quoted,
and so the quote from me has reappeared in some form, and that is not a real quote to begin with, and totally makes me look like some frat boy, like high school asshole.
It totally does. Yeah,
so if you're Googling me out there, just know. There's tomfoolery about.
Oh god.
Oh man. Where do you want to go with this, and why do you do this? Why you do this first? Why do you do this?
Why you do
what
this,
makes
Mo?
You make art? Why? What's inside of you that has to get out?
Why you do this?
I think I feel.
Tingly?
I feel very tingly and numb.
That's the stuff that I put in your water earlier.
I think I'm doing what I'm doing because I think that it might inspire people to think about things. And I'm not giving myself the weight of activist or politician, but I feel like art is a way to kind of incite social progress.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to do with answering any political or economic or social questions, but to pose them in a way that people now interact with each other in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what are the big world issues that I see all the time?
Right.
And, you know, education or poverty or mental health, and wanting to incite people to think about the way we interact with each other more thoroughly, more with a sense of conviction in what they say, and more with, oh gosh, here's the Egyptian syntax coming out of me, more of a general, a soft, conscious perspective. On
soft
the
conscious. A wider perspective.
A wider maybe? Perspective. Mm-hmm. And just a more of an awareness of the things around them.
Yeah.
I think if a person thinks that they maybe for a moment were a part of something larger than themselves, that they might kind of view the world in a different way. Kind of take in more of the world. Where do I want to go now? I'd like to travel.
Just to travel and take in and experience, or to perform
to work.
As well.
Yeah, uh-huh. To travel to work. I'd love to. I want to travel, but I only feel like I should be given that option if I financially can take care of it. So,
yeah.
I hope that travel will come about because of my work. Or
sure.
For my work, and I'd like to. You know, I just hope that I don't ever lose this sense of I don't need to feel competitive. And I hope that I'm doing this work for a long time. And whether it's conceptually as an artist for film or video games or theater, or as an actor or an acting coach or a director, I hope that I can be given the opportunity to do all those things. And if I'm not given it, then I will give it to myself.
What is, in your travels, like, the weirdest, maybe it's from, you know, when you went back home to, or not home necessarily, because, go back to your home!
That's right, not the first time I've heard it.
No, I'm kidding. I've only
been to your ancestral home.
Fuck yourself.
Ancestral. When you went home to Israel, did you have fun?
Right. That's what, because it's written right down there next to that, which is why I thought of it. But, alright, so, anyways, what's like the weirdest snack that you've come across? And it can be like gross or like weird or like in terms of the animal or what it comes from, or it can be something just like very like simple, like something simple that they ate that was just like very strange.
Sugar cane juice.
Yeah. Where is this?
In the city of Cairo.
Okay. In Egypt.
Chilled. Yeah. Menyel is what they call it, the area. This guy with glass mugs has a little like back end of a store, but it's a bar.
And making my mouth water.
He chills the glasses, or maybe he doesn't. I don't know. It comes out, I guess, pretty cold. Maybe the stalks are being kept cold. And he just pulls out a stalk and puts it through a huge juicer, big metal juicer.
Oh, man. So just a fresh stalk of sugar cane.
Into the mug.
Does he have, like, soaking in anything, or just...
He'll take the mug and he'll clean it, because he just kind of, like,
No, I mean the sugar cane soaking in anything.
Oh, I don't... No.
Okay. So let's set up a sugar cane stand, like just a lemonade stand.
Frothy. It's, like, the consistency of milk, and it's delicious.
What does it taste like?
Drooling.
Like... have you ever chewed on sugar cane?
Yeah. Well, I've had like this, it's called agua dulce, I had when I was in Costa Rica the first time, but then I got later on. And I think it might just be like cane sugar, but like they would just take like that and it like chop it up and put it in hot water and basically make like a tea. And it was very like sweet and molasses-y kind of flavor. Oh man, but it would just like warm you from the belly out, and it was oh my god, just like so good.
Now I'm just thinking about like the best sweets I've ever had.
Oh man,
those maple candies.
Oh man, those were candy. So
and
good.
You can't get them like anywhere except in places where they have real maple trees, like fucking Vermont and Maine.
Yeah.
And they cost like $7 a gram. It's insane. You buy like a little tin for like $25. And it's like you get three tiny morsels of god maple.
So good. Oh. Well, I had these when I was in Israel, I had these things called, they're called like bonbon or something like that.
Bamba.
No, they're called bamba.
Bamba.
And it looks like a cheese curl, but you eat
it's actually a goat penis.
And it tastes, it's like peanut butter. It's like a cheese curl, but peanut butter. It's so, so weird, but, like, good, and just, like, you always expect cheese when you have that, like, texture from being in the United States, and it's, like, peanut butter in a way that you've never had peanut butter. And it's so...
Is it peanut butter within, or is it...
It's, like...
Is it that kind of that texture of styrofoam, like, all the way through, or...
Yeah, like, all the way through, and it's, like, the outside
but it's
as
the
opposed
flavor
to being,
is peanuts.
As opposed to being, like, dusted with, like, orange cheese.
Yeah.
It's dusted with, like brown peanut.
Tannish.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, it's
do you know what they actually were? Were they actually a peanut confectionery?
Yeah, I'm sure. They're bomb. They're like peanut cheese curls.
Like, oh,
they
like
sell
a
them.
Peanut confectionery.
I found them in the States, and they actually have this little like. So Gingy. All right. So this is gonna lead into another
Bamba
story.
Bamba Gingy.
Gingy. I didn't used to like the term ginger because I didn't understand where it came from for a redhead. I thought it was just bullshit and ignorant, whatever. But so apparently Gingy. Apparently is like Hebrew for redhead, and so I was like, I can get down with that if there's like an actual root word for it. But so they have as like their mascot, they have this like little baby with this little like curly sprout of like red hair.
Wait, their mascot, the Gingies?
The Bambas.
The peanut shoes. Peanut people.
Has a little redheaded baby
Gingy
who like is like skateboarding or doing karate.
The
or,
Gingy
like,
Bamba
yeah,
baby.
Doing, it's awesome.
Doo, doo, doo. Gingy Bamba baby.
It's
now.
Great. And they sell them in the States, and I found them. And I videoed myself taking it for like trying one for the first time and my reaction, and then my brother tried it, and I videoed his reaction too.
The Gingy Bamba reaction video. When and what is the worst fashion decision you guys have ever made?
The worst was in like middle school when I didn't know like that wearing like sweatpants to school, like, all the, like, I didn't like jeans. I didn't like wearing jeans. So I would just, like, wear sweatpants. And I would have, like, the sweatpants that had, like, the scrunchy thing at the bottom. So it was, like...
tied off.
Yeah, it was, like, bungeed at the bottom. So it wasn't just, like...
the bottom of your feet.
Yeah. Little scrunchies. Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't know that you could just, like, cut those and, like, break the elastic. So I would just have these, like, terrible scrunchy sweatpants.
MC Hammer.
Oh, man. Not even, like, oh, if only...
Did you have a moment where you, like, suddenly realized that wasn't cool anymore?
My sister was like, you gotta stop wearing clothes like that. She's like, she was always trying to make me, like, she's like, I'll make you, because we were so into labels then. It was like, are you going to be a prep? Are you going to be a skater? Mm. Are you going to be a punk? You know, like, what are you going to be?
Your sister remade your image.
Well, she wanted me to be a prep. And I was like, no way. I'm going to be a skater.
Yeah.
And that's when I started getting into the cooler clothing. But
cooler clothing.
No, that was a rough time. And especially when you're at that age and you're like, popping all sorts of, like, random boners at times throughout the day and in the morning. And you're, like,
in gym class.
You're just like, shorts. Sweatpants. And you're just like, what am I to do? And you're, like, even tucking it up, you're still, like, you got this a lot.
Will you come up to the board and answer this question for us?
No, not yet.
I can answer it for you.
I need to sit down having a religious experience based on what you just said.
Oh, man, no, the worst time...
spread throughout my body,
the worst time
stiffening.
Was the bus ride in the morning. Because, like, that's, like, the time when you're, like, waking up and, like, you know, some males might be familiar with the term morning wood.
Oh.
Females may or may not be aware
now,
of this.
Now, wait, does the term morning wood refer to the fact that some people experience wood in the morning?
And by wood, you mean an erection.
The stiffening of the genitals?
Yes. That would be that. You know, you're kind of waking up. That is what I'm talking about.
It makes it really difficult to pee.
Well, yeah, it can, certainly.
So go on.
But so, you know, you're finally kind of waking up on the bus, and you're on this, like, bumpy bus for, like, a half an hour or whatever it is. And then you've got
getting
this...
into it.
Well, no, you're just kind of, like, drifting off back to sleep, like, getting into, like,
fall
whatever.
Asleep.
And then, you know, then you have to take this long walk from the bus into the school right past
Hopefully
everyone.
It's cold.
Oh, yeah.
So that might help a little bit.
Maybe, but maybe not. Then at least you'll be wearing some layers that you can, like... You know, maybe throw your... I don't know, dude. There's trouble.
I had a shoulder bag. I didn't have a backpack. So I had the... Because a backpack starts messing with my lower back, so I got a shoulder bag. Now I have a bad shoulder. But, so I used to cover... instead of wearing it behind me, I'd just bring it around.
That's how you would settle your ankle boners?
That's how I would smuggle my penis into school.
We want to thank our friend Mustafa for coming in here again.
Thank you, Mo. Our dear friend.
Absolutely.
Thank you guys for having me.
You are officially the first guest on People Are Strange.
Yeah, you're the first guest. And now, if you're listening to this before October 4th, all three of us will be performing at the Annapolis Fringe Festival on October 4th. So come on down. And if you mention the podcast to us, John Kevin has agreed to give you $20. It was right after you hit your head.
20 American dollars or 20 like doll hairs?
Actually, it was 20 imaginary dollars. So if you
are you
do
saying
come,
dollars or doll hairs?
Doll hairs. I'm saying doll hairs.
Hey, you should bring a bag of Monopoly money with you just in case.
Okay. Yeah, just in case. We will give you some.
Someone's going to be legitimately upset now, and I'm going to have no other option but to give them your home address.
There we go. But come out and see us.
Come out and see us. Yeah, yes. Say hello.
And thanks again to Mo.
Yeah, thanks Mo. Stuff. We'll get you back on here.
Yeah.
See what you're
this
up to.
A lot of fun.
Down the line.
Have a good night. Drive safe. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Okay, bye.
Right, he's left now. We can talk about what we really think.
Oh my God. Now you guys, if you liked him, write in and tell us. If you didn't like him, write in and tell us.
I'm still here. And I'll find out at the end of the day.
Oh my God.
You'll have hurt my feelings.
He does have a lot of feelings.
I have a lot of feelings.
Remember, we did tell you that he's like very like, you know, a sympathetic kind of character. You would say aw if you saw him.
Yeah. He's all worthy. Time's up! Get out!
Thank you for joining us for People Are Strange. If you enjoyed the show, please like us on Facebook. Subscribe to us on YouTube and iTunes. Email us, andyandjk@gmail.com.
And most importantly, tell your friends.
I'm Andy.
And I'm JK.
Be sure to check back with us next week for another exciting new episode of People Are Strange.